Had enough of the excuse-making, lack of accountability, and psychobabble? Then you're in the right place. You're listening to the Voice of Reason, and we're here to help you reconnect with your inner common sense. Now, here's the host of the Voice of Reason, Deneen Manette.
Hello, everybody. Thank you so much for joining me today on this wonderful Tuesday. This is Deneen Manette, and I am the host of the Voice of Reason. You can find me here every Tuesday at 11 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. And I'm glad you're joining me. I am also the author of Ultimate Betrayal, an infidelity guide to help people deal with infidelity, and Messages for Joey, which is a book that I penned for my daughter, but is great for all young ladies who are coming of age and dealing with all types of issues and challenges that they face. So I'm glad that you were able to join me. Once again, I am here in the Bay Area. I'm a criminal investigator, and I also do quite a bit of television media things, and I'm someone who always likes to spout my opinion, and I'm very opinionated. So if you don't have an opinion about something, you're welcome to ask me. I will give you one of mine. And hopefully we can get some dialogue going here. I can maybe say some things and bring some points of view up that will hopefully inspire, maybe educate, entertain, piss off, whatever. But thanks so much for joining me today. I wanted to talk about some of the issues that I've been seeing in the media. I like to bring up things that have bothered me throughout the week and see if I can't put it out there and expound upon my particular viewpoint and opinion about certain things. And something that was really disturbing to me that I saw that happened, you know, over this past week was the television shooting that happened in Virginia, in Roanoke, Virginia. And the whole thing was pretty much televised. I mean, all of the major components, the major parts were televised. And if anybody out there didn't see it or hear about it, I don't know, maybe you're under a rock, I'm not sure. But in any event, it was a pretty big story. And what happened was, just to recap, last Wednesday, and this was during a live morning broadcast, a live morning television broadcast on WDBJ television, and that's in Roanoke, Virginia. A reporter by the name of Allison Parker, she's 24 years old, and her cameraman, Adam Ward, 27, they were doing a news story, a very, you know, random news story with one interviewing someone from the Chamber of Commerce about tourism, just something very innocuous, just a regular news story. They were working for a CBS affiliate, and while they were on the air, while they were doing their jobs, they were gunned down. They were fatally ambushed during a live broadcast. And I don't know how many of you may have seen that, but it was just so alarming. They're just in the middle. She's in the middle of a conversation interviewing a woman, and then the shots ring out. But for a very long time, the gunman who used to work for the station, his name was Vester Flanagan, he stood there and just watched them, watched the interview take place while he was pointing the gun in their direction. It was really, really eerie. I was able to see the entire footage. He videotaped himself while he was doing the whole thing. So, and it was eventually taken down off of most of the networks, off of most of the social media networks and sites, even though you can still find it if you search. But he was videotaping himself. He wanted to make a statement. He wanted to document, make a diary, make a journal, whatever, of this entire incident. So he stood there for quite some time while this interview was taking place with his gun pointed at Allison. And she wasn't paying attention because she was paying attention to what she was doing, the person that she was interviewing. So it was really just so eerie. And I'm somebody who's there after a crime. I'm somebody, as a criminal investigator, who comes upon a scene that's cold. There's no body there. There's no screaming, crying mama falling on the ground. I'm just there to gather the evidence and the information and talk to the witnesses. But I have never been at a scene during a time when a crime was actually taking place. So even for me, who's not easily rattled by dead bodies and gruesome things, this was very disturbing just to see this person who was about to do something and actually do it. And you hear the gunshots ring out, and it's just really, it's just unnerving, absolutely unnerving. And the woman who was being interviewed, her name was Vicki Gardner. She also was shot, but she wasn't killed. She was shot. She ended up losing part of a kidney, she lost a kidney and part of her colon. But as of, I guess the last update I heard was last Friday or Saturday, she was considered to be in good condition, and she did not have life-threatening injuries. And so that was wonderful. But the other two lost their lives. Allison and Adam, they lost their lives during this incident. And it's really, really just so disturbing. It really was very upsetting to people in the broadcast community all over the country, because a lot of people get their starts in these smaller markets. And, you know, you're out there basically unprotected. A lot of things have been happening to news crews, even here in the Bay Area. We've had them robbed and pistol whipped during live news broadcasts and just within the last month. So a lot of things have been going on, and you're virtually unprotected. Your equipment is stolen, your vehicles are broken into, but they're out here gathering the news stories, giving us the information that we as the public is used to. We demand it. It's what it feeds our community. It helps us to understand what's going on. So they were just out there doing their jobs. And this whack job, once again, his name was Vester Flanagan, 41 years old, who had an axe to grind and a bone to pick, decided that he was going to take it out on them on live television. And once again, you know, the two died, the cameraman as well as Allison. And homicide was listed as the manner of death for both of them. So, of course, we all knew that because we saw the shots ring out, and we heard shortly thereafter when their station manager took the air and announced that they had actually been killed. They'd lost their lives during that incident. But the medical examiner didn't specify how many times Parker and Ward were shot during this attack. It was just noted that she died from gunshot wounds to the head and to the chest, and he died from gunshot wounds to the head and to the torso. So who was this Vester Flanagan dude? He's someone who used to use the name of Bryce Williams when he was on air, and he'd actually been fired from the station back in 2013. He was a reporter, and according to the station manager, before he was fired, he had initially been ordered to get counseling beforehand, which he reportedly did. So obviously, there were some issues going on with him that were notable early on. And they felt that, you know, maybe a little bit of counseling would help this dude or whatever. But prior to firing him, he was given the opportunity to get counseling, and he did get the counseling, which obviously apparently did not work. So there was a history with him. This didn't just come up overnight. This came out of nowhere. And this was back in 2013 that he was fired. So basically he was holding on to this for 2 years, at least 2 years, this grudge. So that's very distressing that somebody is walking around so angry for so long. And then after he was fired, he ended up suing the station for discrimination and wrongful termination. In the court papers, the station rebutted his claims and says that basically he was let go for unsatisfactory job performance, and that after he was fired, he made some very frightening, alarming statements. He basically told the station manager as he was being fired, quote, "You better call police because I'm going to make a big stink," which is, you know, something that needed to have been made note of, which was in the court filings. And the police ended up coming and escorting him out of the facility. And as he was leaving, he took a wooden cross, reportedly, and put it in the news director's hand and said, quote, "You'll need this." So that's really indicative of somebody who has quite a problem. And that's something that's very disturbing. And I think if I had seen something like that unfolding in front of my eyes, I would have been thinking, oh, whoa, this is going to be a problem. So his case was eventually dismissed. But, you know, all of these things were brought up in the court filings. And basically, from the time he was let go until now, they're trying to figure out what happened to him in those 2.5 years since he was fired. He thought he was going to get away with this, obviously. He planned this for quite some time. Don't know if he spent the last 2.5 years planning it, but he did put a lot of effort and time into this attack, into this homicide, this ambush. He had a whole lot of things in a rented vehicle. He parked his car somewhere at an airport or something, and he had a whole bunch of things in his getaway car, that which led the authorities to believe that he thought he was going to get away with this. They found a Glock pistol. They found a whole bunch of ammunition, a to-do list. They haven't released the contents of the to-do list, but a whole list of things that he was planning to do that were on his list of activities after he committed these homicides. And he was not arrested for quite some time after the homicides. There was a briefcase in the car with different license plates in it, a wig, a shawl, sunglasses, you know, all which were a sign that this guy was planning to get away, and he had a disguise and he pretty much had a plan. And then they went back to his apartment, which was also really freaky. it was barely any furniture in there. I saw some of the pictures. It was barely furnished. It was very impersonal. And there were headshots of himself plastered all over the refrigerator. I mean, who does that? That is just so icky. I mean, I'm just thinking, my gosh, who puts their own pictures all over their refrigerator? I mean, you can have a couple of you and the kids and the dog and the plants and the grandkids and the nieces, but who plasters their refrigerator with pictures of themselves? This guy was really disturbed, the whole thing. He seems really weird. He's the kind of person, apparently, that had problems everywhere he went, and he was always a victim. These people, they call them injustice collectors. I heard that term recently, which means that they go from place to place racking up injustices. Nothing is ever right. Everything is they're being targeted everywhere they go. They are always the victim. And I know that we know people that way. I know people that way, that in every situation, everywhere they go, every job they have, every school they go to, they're always the victim. Somebody is always mistreating them, doing them wrong, making them about to go off. Oh, I'm about to go off up in here. Everywhere they go. And you start having to look at that person and say, you're the common denominator here. You're the one that always seems to have a problem. And you wonder where it came from. This guy, I'm sorry, I don't want to call him a kid. He's 41 years old. But this man came from privilege. He came from having it all. He was a pro football player's son. So obviously they grew up with some money. He lived in a very affluent area in the Bay Area, which was in the Oakland Hills, an area I'm very familiar with. A lot of the pro athletes live up there. Very expensive homes. A lot of those homes were destroyed in the Oakland Hills fire back in 1991. And these are million-dollar-plus homes up there. So he's from there. He was homecoming prince of his high school. He was a very popular kid. He seemed to be the type that had it all. So you wonder, what happened? What happens when a kid who seems like they have it all turn into a vicious murderer? What makes somebody snap like that? What makes you change? This, he goes on as his life evolves. I mean, it seems like he goes to college, he gets an education, he's on television, his friends back home are bewildered, they don't know what happened to him. He seemed like, you know, he was doing well for himself. But his contention was that he was mistreated because he was black, and oh, he was mistreated because he was gay. Now, that's a horrible combination now, isn't it? So, and these things didn't come to light until he sent this manifesto to ABC News, and that claimed that all of the actions that he had done that morning were in retaliation for this racial discrimination, and that his thoughts and desires to do this were particularly triggered by the massacre of the 9 black churchgoers in Charleston. You know, he wrote himself, why did I do it? I put down a deposit on the gun on 6/19. The church shooting in Charleston happened on 6/17. This is what he wrote. And that sent, what sent me over the top was the church shooting. And my hollow point bullets have the victim's initial on them. Ah, please. I don't believe that for 1 second. I don't believe that for 1 second at all. You know what I think? I think this guy was just a spoiled brat. At one time, he had it all. He had everything that he wanted. He was the king of the ball. He lived in the hills. His dad was popular, whatever. And he just had it all. But at this point in his life, he realized that he was on the verge of being a total loser. An absolute total loser. And what do we do when we decide that we are going to be a total loser? We blame everybody. We blame the I'm black, I'm gay, I don't know what his other issues were. That's all he pretty much pointed out. I'm angry. What are you so angry about? Just yesterday you had everything, and now today, you know, you're dealing with a little bit of struggle. And I have gone on and on this show about what happens when we raise our children to not have to deal with struggle and to give everything to them. The moment something goes wrong in their life and things aren't adding up the way they want them to, they're on the verge of being a loser, and they blame. And when they blame, they take out their aggressions on others. And I think that's exactly what happened in this situation. But we'll talk about this more after the break.
Welcome back to the Voice of Reason. Here's Deneen Manette.
Welcome back. It's Denise Minette, and we're talking again about the WDBJ shooting last week of young Allison Parker and Adam Ward, who were shot by that loser, Vester Flanagan, an absolute loser. They were in their early 20s. He was 41. I mean, what 41-year-old man goes and stalks some basics and kids? You know, what a friggin' loser. Anyway, so we're talking about him, and my opinion is that he was just jealous. He was jealous because he was a loser and his life was getting to be middle-aged and he just didn't have anything, so he's going to take what they had. They were young. They were both in love with other people, but they were at the beginning of their lives. They were both engaged to be married. They had it all. They had everything he wanted. They had jobs, which he didn't have because he couldn't keep because he was a loser. They had their youth, which he had wasted his, being spoiled and entitled and looking for victimization status. And so they had love. I don't hear anyone stepping forward saying that they were his partner or his, you know, dude or whatever it was that he had. None of those people. I don't hear any friends, really, any current friends stepping forward. No one who knew him presently, just a bunch of people that said he was disgruntled and evil. So basically they had everything and he had nothing. So therefore he attempted to make himself more famous and he wanted to make sure we remembered his name and that he was important for at least one day by using this action-ready GoPro-style camera to film his crime. You know, he typed a 23-page manifesto now. Keep that in mind. He wanted to make sure everybody knew his story that he faxed over to ABC News after the shooting while he was on the run. I guess he stopped off at a FedEx or something and did this. You know, he ditched his car at the local airport. He was in the rental car, but he did all of this to make sure that we knew who he was, and I guess that he could get away and then be able to at least enjoy the fruits of his popularity, his sudden fame and notoriety, by seeing the story about himself in the news. Well, too bad he got killed. He killed himself while he was on the run because his getaway plan was obviously not good enough because he's dead now, so he didn't get to enjoy all of his fame. Boo-hoo. In any event, after he ran from the scene of the crime, after he completely massacred these two people and attempted to massacre the third, he was updating his social media accounts all the way. He'd set up a bunch of accounts within the months leading up to this during his entire plan, and he was updating them. He was typing, tweeting out. He was uploading videos to Facebook and links to Twitter. And I mean, he was just absolutely going to work with this. And, you know, basically what that means is that where he'd failed after years of trying in the traditional media, because he basically obviously wasn't good enough online, he became in an infamous second. He became infamous in a second, in an instant. He now became infamous because he was a failure at what he thought he was going to be good at, which was traditional media. And this, you know, what he'd wanted his entire life, according to those who knew him, he'd yearned to be famous his entire life. And so now he had the opportunity to do it. And which is really, really sad, because if he didn't make it, maybe as an on-air broadcaster, maybe he was good. But when people don't like you and they don't want to work with you or they don't want to be around you, you suck. So it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how good you are at your job. If nobody wants to work with you, guess what? You're not going to have one because you suck. Nobody wants to be around somebody that is obnoxious. And if you're always looking to pick a fight everywhere you go, guess what? You're going to be a loser. So at 41, he's now a manic loser. And I'm sure his opinion was, it doesn't matter as long as they're talking about me, right? I mean, that's what people say. You know, as long as I'm hitting the press, that's all that matters. Well, you're dead. You can't enjoy it. So, oh, well. But it just leads me to wonder and to think. Are we as Americans, are we as a society and as a culture, are we all accomplices in this madness? Are we accomplices in this ego-stroking, pontificating need to be seen and needed by psychos? Are we accomplices by watching, by sharing, by discussing the content of his postings? Are we somehow all culpable? Are we helping to spread the madness of this guy's rantings? Are we actually part of the problem? YouTube and Facebook, yeah, they tried to take down the stuff that he was posting, but not before these things were shared hundreds and thousands of times. Basically, providing a platform, you and I, I didn't personally share anything, but I was looking at the things that other people had shared. And other thousands of people did do the sharing of the links. I mean, this stuff went viral. So are we in essence providing whack jobs a platform? We're kind of actually a component in the madness, because as a culture, as a society, as part of this voyeuristic group of people that have to push the button share before we think twice about it, are we as Americans, actually worldwide, are we as a new social media culture providing platforms for these whack jobs to spew their psychoness? Look at remember Elliot Rogers, the shooter from Santa Barbara, who also, by the way, who was from an elite family, a doctor, and traveled the world and, you know, was part of this very, very rich, isolated community growing up and was very affluent. And I guess they call that affluenza, I've heard now. But in any event, he was from this elite family. He was also somebody who was spoiled, who was upset because he couldn't find love, who was angry, who also made a video. I saw his video as well on YouTube, and spread his message after he wrote also a manifesto. He's another one that before his rampage, his rantings, he uploaded this stuff onto YouTube, which was shared hundreds and thousands of times, creating a platform for madness. And while I'm on it, what is up with this manifesto situation? Are manifestos ever anything positive? Does anybody ever write a manifesto about curing cancer or ending world hunger? Or are manifestos always some crazy ranting? I mean, I don't know. I think I need to look that up. Is the definition of manifesto psycho babblings from hell? I mean, if I look it up in the dictionary, is it going to say psycho babbling crazy schizo maniacs from hell spewing foolishness? I just don't get it. The Unabomber that wrote a manifesto. Christopher Dorner. Remember Christopher Dorner, the one that shot up all those cops and was on that big rampage against the LAPD? I guess it was probably like the summer before last. I read his manifesto. I actually found that thing pretty fascinating, and I found there to be quite a bit of truth in it. But the fact of the matter is the manifesto something that is just the indicator of you about to go off and do a mass shooting? If your coworker is typing a manifesto, is that a clue that maybe you ought to take some time off or not go into the office? I just don't ever hear the term manifesto associated with anything positive. I always hear it associated with a whack job. So I don't know. I'm going to have to do some more investigating into that. But it just seems like, you know, we've got Christopher Dorner, we got Vester Psycho, we got the Unabomber, we got Elliot Roger. All these people wrote a manifesto. So I'm telling you right now, if somebody I know is over here typing a manifesto, I'm going to really take note of that and, act accordingly. But as far as, you know, these sharing of videos and sending each other the links and to these manifestos, because like I said, I've seen all these videos. I looked them all up. I typed them all in, did a Google search, found them all, read all the manifestos, was very interested in Elliot Rogers' manifesto, like I said already, Christopher Dorner's manifesto. But why is it that we share these things? Isn't this how ISIS spreads its rhetoric? Don't they use social media and the public to share their rhetoric? Remember that whole Jordanian pilot thing? Remember the pilot that was set on fire in the cage? One of the most disturbing things I think I have ever seen in my life. And the key phrase there is I've ever seen. Now, why is it that I've even seen that? That's the key point. Why have I seen it? Because I looked for it and I watched it because it was online. And there's a big debate all the time as to, well, you know, it's better to know than not to know. And, you know, if you see something, then it makes you become more outraged about it. And it takes, you know, you take action. I don't think that's what it is. I don't think people watch stuff just to be outraged so they can take action, because I don't see any action having been taken, and I don't believe that you have to see something personally to recognize that it's real, to recognize the gravity of it. I know that there are child molesters out there. I don't need to see a video of child molestation in order to think it's real. I mean, what the hell? You don't need to see everything just to get the full impact of it so we can get outraged and take action. No, I don't believe that. I think it's our voyeuristic desire to see. I think it's the entire car crash thing. How traffic slows way down so we can get a good long look at the carnage on the side of the road. It has nothing to do with, okay, I'm going to slow down because I see the carnage. People just like to look. All of us just like to look. So we kind of need to own this. And honestly, I think it's making us all become indifferent to human life. I wonder if it's just kind of like a ew moment rather than a call to action. Are we becoming indifferent to human life? And are we becoming indifferent to all humans? Now tell me, honestly, everyone who saw the Jordanian pilot being burned up in the cage, which was just stomach wrenching. It was one of those things that once you see, you just cannot unsee it. It was just horrific. Would people have watched that if it was a cage full of children? What if ISIS had taken a cage full of children and set them on fire? Do you think we'd be able to watch that? Do you think we would be able as a society to actually sit and watch that? I don't think I could. I don't know because I've seen a lot. I don't think I could have seen that. Now, and what about dogs? What if ISIS had put a bunch of dogs in the cage and set them on fire? Would we be able to watch that? I couldn't watch that. I couldn't watch it. I couldn't watch the kids and I couldn't watch the dogs. So what is it? There is a point where we do cut off. There is a point when we do say, you know what? I've had enough and I'm not going to look at this. But it has nothing to do with the fact that I have to see it in order to take action. It is just our desire to see, to spread, to be able to say we know, and to curiosity. So maybe we are the problem. Maybe our insatiable need to view the car accident will be the death of us. I mean, is there anything shocking to us anymore? Or do we just want as many likes and shares as possible on our statuses? Do we just want to make sure that people see the things that we want them to see? Are we domestic terrorists simply because our voyeuristic nature, coupled with our own need to be the first to share the story, has corrupted us, has desensitized us? It makes you wonder. Curiosity's natural. Yeah, I get that. But when we pull out our camera and become part of the story, part of the problem, that's something completely else. When we're not there to offer help, but we're there to get something so we could upload it to get some shares and some likes, that's a problem. So, in this situation with Vester Flanagan, in these mass shootings, these things that are uploaded and shared and viewed by all of us, if this happens again, when this happens again, we can't attend the vigils, we can't cry in anguish, we can't complain about this crappy world we live in, when we're the enablers, the conduits, in essence, the advertisers of evil. We can't complain about the things that we continue as a people to perpetuate. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to the Voice of Reason. Here's Denine Minette.
Welcome back. It's Denine Minette, still with the Voice of Reason, and I'm going to switch gears just a little bit. Been talking about the entire thing, the Virginia shooting at the news station with the cameraman and the reporter last week. And I want to go into the issue and the situations involving recognizing potential workplace violence. I think that a lot of people don't really recognize the signs of a situation that could lead to workplace violence. Now, this situation back in Virginia, 2.5 years ago, this guy was fired, but he still held a grudge. And I really think that it's important for people to recognize when they are in potential dangers, when their office environment is compromised, and what they need to do about it. I really don't think people understand that, and I'd like to take some time to touch on this. And this is something that's kind of personal to me, because we had a situation a couple of years ago in our office, and I still to this day believe that the person that was fired from our office is still out there, is still crazy, is still hell-bent on bringing down certain individuals in our office, and will do whatever is necessary to make that happen. This is also another individual who has a history of being an injustice justice collector, who was making all types of accusations about people, staff members, supervisors, different folks within the establishment, was just really, really hell-bent on lying. And this person happened to be a pathological liar who was creating so much discord within the office and was trying to form alliances with different people against other people. And I still, till this day, I've spoken with my supervisor about that. I've still, to this day, don't understand what his ultimate agenda was. Was it as a way to climb to the top of the ladder, the corporate ladder, or was it just to cause chaos and discord? So that's something that is just really, really disturbing, because we still just don't know what it was that this guy, what his reason was, what his rationale was. Still don't have any idea what that was all about. But in any event, he was fired. And he happened to be a military sharpshooter and didn't find those things out until his desk was cleaned out. But I mean, there are people out there that are really hell-bent on getting their revenge. And I was one of the people in the office who pushed to have peepholes put in our doors, just because I wanted to be able to see who was outside before that person was able to make it in. So that guy is still out there. He's still angry. Don't know if he's gone on to another job or another position in which he is more likely to have had more interactions with those folks that were negative, that trumped what was going on in our office. But the fact of the matter is that guy is still out there. And therefore, I'm very, very alert and aware that this exists, and I think that people need to know in general. Violent incidents in the workplace ordinarily follow some sort of trigger, and that trigger usually pushes an already vulnerable person to take drastic actions. So you need to be wary of employees who start to behave in ways that I'm going to outline now. These are the type of people you need to keep your eye on. Number one, people who say they've been treated unfairly. The injustice collectors, the people that are always saying that they're not being treated properly. Now, sometimes, you know, of course, there's some validity to that. People aren't being treated fairly. People are getting screwed. That happens all the time. But somebody who goes from situation to situation and just seems to always be the one that is pinpointed and is not being treated fairly is a person you need to keep your eye on. They're the kind of person that say that they're the number two, say that they're always being forced to wait for something, a promotion, a raise. You know, this person's always being screwed around and dangled. Something's dangled in front of them, and they're always waiting for something, and they're always angry. Number three, they show signs of mental instability. Now you know when somebody is not acting right. You know when somebody is showing some mental instability. You know the rantings, the paranoia. I don't have to tell you what mental instability looks like. We all have it either in our family, in our friend circle, in our social circle. You know the person that's not wrapped too tight. So keep an eye on that one. The one at the job that's always complaining, that's never getting enough money, and that's not wrapped too tight. Keep an eye on that one. They begin to isolate themselves or is thought of as a loner. Maybe somebody who's just kind of off to themselves and doesn't seem to have many friends. Someone who doesn't eat with anybody, who doesn't really hang out after work with anybody. You know, that those are red flags. And keep in mind, these are just red flags. There's somebody who's very social and could actually snap and become a violent killer in the workplace. But this is just, these are just general signs, generalized signs to look for. Or number five, maybe they've recently been disciplined for something. And maybe that was the tipping point for them. Maybe they're already a little crazy, a little angry, a little lonely, you know, a little broke because they're not getting paid enough. And now, oh my God, now you're going to discipline me for being late. I've had it. You know, that's the person you need to kind of keep your eye on. So that those are some telltale signs or just things that you just need to be aware of. Those are some typical characteristics. Now, people who are most likely to commit crimes within the workplace. Now, the first things I read you were basically the type of triggers. Those are triggers that usually kind of set people off. The type of people who are usually, according to, you know, the criminal justice system data, that are most likely to commit these things are people who have a history of violent behavior, and that also, you know, includes people who've been involved in the criminal justice system themselves, who've been arrested, have arrest records, are known to get in fights, but they have a history of violent behavior. They tend to be middle-aged white males, but as you can see, that's not the case. I mean, here, look at Vester. He's not middle-aged white anything. He's, you know, a black gay guy, so almost not quite middle-aged, but in any event, you know, this is just a prototype. It's not necessarily a definite. It's just a prototype. But they get upset with having low-level tasks to do, the type of person who feels as though they're not being respected, their mind and their work abilities not being respected, and they're given little bones and coffee to make and things that they feel are beneath them. They're bitter and unhappy type people who are always complaining. How you doing? Oh, I could be better. Oh, Lord, I wish I hadn't asked you. I mean, you know, that type of person. And you know when you see that person coming, because I used to work with that person, and I would never ask him how he was doing, because he couldn't just say, oh, fine, how are you, or how you doing, oh, I'm good, or thank you, or whatever. No, every time you said, how you doing, oh, Mel, girl, you don't have time to hear it all. Oh, God, you know, I mean, we all have problems, dude, move on. So anyway, that person, the bitter, unhappy person, the person with no job security, who is kind of like not knowing whether or not they're going to make it. Maybe there's something going on, there's some layoffs, there's things happening at work, the downsizing, something's going on. This person's not feeling like they're real secure in their position. Somebody new has come on board who's doing a much better job. Keep an eye. These are the type of people that typically get involved in these commit workplace violence type situations. A lot of times they've had problems growing up. Bad grades in school, abusive parents, you know. And once again, Vester didn't fit in any of these categories pretty much. So other than the constantly bitter and complaining type person. But, you know, he didn't fit in any of these categories. So these are just a prototype. They're not a definite, but definitely keep an eye out. People who've, you know, had abusive parenting or just grown up in real crappy type home environments. And people who have substance abuse issues, who are maybe heavily medicated, or they're drinkers, or they're just people that, you know, may have definite substance abuse issues. So These are definite signs of people that you should keep an eye out. Different triggers of things that you should be aware of in your workplace, in your environment, to make sure that maybe, you know, you're a little bit more cautious and conscientious of what's going on around you. And violence often occurs as well during meetings between managers and employees. So if the employee is unhappy with the meeting, and if you schedule a meeting with an employee and you feel that employee may become violent, if you're going to fire them, if you're going to discipline them, as a manager, as an employer, there are things that you also need to do also. You shouldn't even let the employee necessarily know that the meeting is scheduled. It's probably better if you're going to fire somebody, or if you're going to discipline them and they have a tendency to maybe be a little bit unstable, to just say, hey, let me talk to you for a minute in my office, as opposed to scheduling a meeting, because that gives them time to plan and to get their gun and ammunition together to come in there and shoot you. So maybe you ought to just pull them inside and say, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? Have someone else present. Don't have a meeting with that person by themselves if that person is unstable and something bad has a potential of happening. When they're being evaluated, when you're evaluating an employee, make sure you say good things about them, not just bad things. You know, even if you're disciplining them, you need to put some good stuff in there. You need to bring the level of criticism down so that they can be open to hearing your entire presentation, as opposed to wanting to take out their gun and shoot you. Not a good plan. You never want to attack them. You never want to insult them. You never want to yell at them. You want to always remain calm when you talk. Now, you know, one of the old things that you learned years ago in good communication skills and in diffusement and in anxiety diffusement situations is that when someone starts yelling, you bring your voice way down. So when someone is saying, I can't believe this is unfair, how could you do this? You bring your voice way down and you say, well, what you don't seem to understand. And that means they have to come down too, because they have to hear what you're saying, and it sets a different tone. So bring your voice way down. No screaming, no yelling, no calling them a jackass. None of those things. Bring your voice way down and calm it down. Remain calm when you talk. Keep a distance between you. A desk is good. You don't want to have a face-to-face meeting with someone that you're about to fire who is violent. You want to make sure there's some distance between you so that when they haul off and punch you, the chances are that they'll miss, or that by the time they get close to your face, you will have had a chance to run and duck and hide. So that's always a really good thing. Make sure that you can reach security. The security is available to be reached, and you stay close to the door just in case you have to leave. Me personally, I have an escape plan. Ever since that dude got fired from our office, I have an escape plan. I have a place in my office where I can hide. And I've already figured it out. And I know to grab my cell phone and get underneath in my secret hiding space and, you know, get a place to hide. Get an escape plan. Figure out how you're gonna get the hell out of there when Psycho Bob and Loser Lucy comes in there shooting the place up. You know, tell somebody. If somebody's acting weird and they constantly are acting weird and you see them over there next to you typing their manifesto, tell somebody. Say something. You know what? I don't want to start anything, but she's typing a manifesto. That's a major clue. Tell somebody. Document everything. Write everything down. You may need it for your settlement that you said something and it wasn't listened to before this person came in shooting. Document everything. And finally, my personal favorite, be as nice to the crazy person as you can. You don't have to be too chummy. Don't get into their personal life or their affairs, but be really nice to the crazy person. I'm telling you, that's the person you need to be, as, you know, cordial. The guy at my job that got fired, if he came in there and started shooting, I am one of two people that I do not believe would be on his hit list, because I was always super nice and helpful to him. And the worst thing you can do to a crazy, unstable person is to treat them like they're crazy and unstable. That's just like a total bad plan. It's just not going to work out 99% of the time. So if you have to, you know, walk the walk and talk the talk, recognize, okay, that's the crazy person. I'm not going to be chummy. They're not coming over my house for dinner, but I'm damn sure going to say good morning every day. And I'm damn sure going to have a smile on my face, because that's the person that has a chance of taking me out. Now, what you can't account for is the person whose ex-husband or wife comes up there and starts shooting. There, you know, hey, all bets are off. But as far as workplace violence, things that you can control, be aware of the triggers. Be aware of the potential candidates and be super nice to the crazy person. Mind your own business. Stay in your own corner. Document and figure out how you're going to get the hell out of there. Okay? We are changing gears and going to our infidelity segment when we come back after the break.
You're listening to the Voice of Reason on TalkZone.com. Here's your host, Deneen Minette.
Welcome back to The Voice of Reason. This is Deneen Minette. And at the end of every show, our last segment is always about infidelity. I'm an infidelity survivor. I am an infidelity coach. I run relationship groups for people who are struggling with the aftermath of infidelity after being victims. And I'm definitely very active on social media and offer a lot of information and insight on my website, which is ultimatebetrayal.com. Written a book, as I stated at the opening, called Ultimate Betrayal, Recognizing, Uncovering, and Dealing with Infidelity. So it's a community that I'm very active in and I'm very supportive of, and I do whatever I can to help those who have dealt with this devastating experience and help them get on to the next chapter of their life. So I always take a question or two from someone who has emailed me during the past week or two about something that they're struggling with and try and address it on air. And this week's question is coming from a woman by the name of Becky. Becky writes, I'm really struggling. My marriage of 13 years ended after my husband had numerous affairs with the same woman. We have two daughters and shared custody of our daughters, 9 and 11. The problem is he is now living with that home wrecking bee. Okay, just know on this show, it's okay to call her a home wrecking bitch. It's fine. So we don't need to use the B. So I'm just going to go ahead and sort bitch. The problem is he is now living with that home wrecking bitch, and I have to drop off or pick up my girls from there weekly. I feel like my life has spiraled out of control, and I go from wanting revenge to just feeling like crap. I hate the fact that they seem to have gone on with their lives and have this wonderful, quote, family, end quote, while I am over here miserable. We have been divorced for about 6 months now, but they moved in together before our divorce was even final. It's as though our marriage meant nothing to him, and now he has some new, younger version of me and seems just fine with that. My life is in shambles. How do I pull myself together? How do I stand back up on my feet? I feel like my world has crumbled and that I've lost everything. Please help me. Oh, Becky, I am so sorry you're going through this. This is an absolute nightmare, and I completely and totally understand what you're going through. But this is what you need to recognize first and foremost. The last thing that you wrote in your letter was, I feel like my world has crumbled and that I've lost everything. And you also ask me, how do I pull myself together? How do I stand back up on my feet? You know how you stand back up on your feet? You look over at your two daughters, ages 9 and 11, and you demonstrate for them how a real woman handles disappointment, sadness, pain, confusion, and frustration. They are watching everything that you're doing. And they see the big picture. They are old enough to have figured out that dad dumped mom and is now shacked up with some other chick. They have figured that out. And part of them is a feeling of rejection because they are connected to you. And even though they may seem as though they're getting along and it's a happy family over there at dad's house, they are feeling a bit of resentment toward him. And I'm sure especially towards her, because they know that their mom is hurting and they know that their mom is devastated and you are an extension of them. So don't put too much energy and emphasis on what seems to be going on over at their house with their, quote, happy family, end quote, because I guarantee you the guilt from what that dirtbag husband of yours, ex-husband of yours did is making it so that he is overcompensating when the girls are with him. I will guarantee you that him and that home wrecking whore are taking the girls to ice cream. They're going to the mall. They're getting whatever they want. That is a fun, fun house over there. They are getting to do anything and everything because he is overcompensating and she is trying to fix the crap that she has done by eliminating the pain from her portion of helping to destroy your family. Her portion. She didn't destroy your family, but she did, you know, she was an enabler and a helper and provided the outlet for your loser ass husband. So in any event, don't concern yourself with how happy it is over there. It's Disneyland over there, sweetheart. It's Disneyland. But your girls are old enough to be able to see the big picture. And as this evolves over time, they're really going to see the big picture. They're really going to know as they start to develop their own love relationships, intimate romantic relationships, they're really going to understand what a crappy creep and a effed up thing their father has done to this family. So don't concern yourself with that. That's a facade. That's a mirage. That's something that's going to blow up in his face, in both of their faces. So that's not your concern. What you need to do each day, every day, is make sure that they recognize how, like I said a minute ago, a real woman gets up out of bed, washes her face, puts on her clothes, fixes her hair, and walks out of that house after she sprays herself with the armor of strength, with resilience, with pride. That's what you do with values, with morals, with courage. That's how you get up. You look at them. They're watching you. If you stay curled up in a ball on the floor in the fetal position yelling about how unfair life is, that is the coping skill that they're going to pick up, and that's what they're going to learn. you are then going to be teaching them that that is how you deal with a job loss, a relationship ending, a disappointment, not getting into a college, not having the friends you want, rejection, defeat. That's how they're going to learn that that is to be handled. And that is absolutely not okay, because we don't need another generation of losers like the home wrecker who can't get crap for herself. So she tries to, you know, cozy up with somebody else's. That helps to destroy a home because she's too lame to get her own man. So that's not the type of woman we want to model for them. We want them to model strength and resilience and pride and courage, tenacity. That's what we need them to see. We need two more women to grow into who they are and who they're supposed to be, not be under somebody's shoe because they can't handle the pressures of life. So that needs to be your motivation. As far as feeling so bad and so miserable because their relationship seems to be great and he doesn't seem to care, you are going to be a thorn in that relationship for the rest of your living days. Every single event that those girls have, everything that you have to do, every time he comes over to drop those girls off, I guarantee you that she's over there nervously biting her fingernails and concerned that he is now falling in love with you again, because you said he had several affairs with the same woman, which to me means he kept leaving her and coming back to you and going back to her and coming back to you. And she is aware that many, many times now he has come back to you and can very well do it again if you would allow him to, but that he has made her promises and that she has turned it on and worn dental floss to bed, but that he still ends up coming back to you, that he still has this affection and affinity for you and for the family. And she is going to be concerned about that for the rest of her living days, that someday the man that she was able to be with and to help, you know, him destroy and lure away from the family in some respect, that he has still got an attachment to you. And she's never going to sleep good at night. Trust me on this. The best thing you can do, sweetheart, is to live your life well, to be successful, to be on the top of your game, take on new activities, join new clubs, go hiking, stay in shape, eat well, read, be educated, do whatever it takes to make you a strong and successful person. Even if you're dying on the inside, even if you're falling apart, you must never let that be known. Let him know in no unspoken terms that he lost the best thing that ever happened to him. Not by anything that you say, not by beating him over the head with it, but by living well. Living well is the best revenge you could possibly have. I'm someone who wrote a book after having experienced this situation. I cried my way all the way to the bank. All the way to the bank. The best revenge is living well, turning lemons into lemonade, landing on your feet with your head high, and doing what it takes to make it to the next level. Closing this door. Forget that. Slamming the damn door shut and looking forward. Your motivation should be your girls, should be modeling for them how to live life as an upstanding woman with values and morals, and making yourself somebody that hooker is going to envy, and that ex-bastard husband of yours will know that he let the best thing in his life go, and you're not coming back. Live your life, sweetheart. Live your life. Be the best you can be. That is the best revenge you can possibly get. And with that will end this week's session, this week's segment of The Voice of Reason. I hope you all have enjoyed listening, and I will see you back here next Tuesday, same time, same place, same station. I appreciate it. Have a great week, everybody.